to begin this discussion of nucleophilic substitution, let's look at this example reaction.
Wait, this is lecture.
This is lecture. So we'll take bromomethane and sodium hydroxide. But let me pause for a moment because I wanted to say a bit about the naming of alkyl halides. So there is the systematic way to name alkyl halides and then the common nomenclature method. So far I've been focusing on the systematic where, for example, we do treat the bromine as a substituent, so we call it bromo, and so we can call this bromomethane. Notice that there's no one used because there is only one carbon methane, so why number it if it's obvious? And so that is a small facet of the rules that we already saw, in fact, when we named ethanol. Ethanol, because whichever carbon you put the oxygen on automatically becomes carbon one, and it's not possible to have ethane to all. That's why we leave the number out in that case as well. Bromomethane, related to that, is the general name for this kind of functional group, which would be haloalkane. Halo, again, being the substituent style name and then tacked onto an alkane. And so this is for systematic nomenclature. The other possibility is we treat the bromide as the important feature of the molecule. So, for example, we can call it methyl bromide. Methyl being the substituent name again, bromide now focusing on the halogen. The general term for this class of compounds using the common nomenclature system would then be alkyl halides. And again, that's for common nomenclature. Now, although in naming compounds, I do prefer generally the systematic, and that will generally be what I ask you for, even my own self, you'll hear me say things like alkyl halides instead of haloalkanes. Or I might say T-butyl bromide, because T-butyl bromide is a little bit quicker than saying, what would that be? 1-bromo-1,1-dimethylethane. T-butyl bromide is a little quicker. So you need to be familiar with both systems. We'll more frequently use the systematic version. Now, since we've tackled that little bit of nomenclature, let's look at the reaction that's going to happen between these two molecules. First, if you're going to take a really logical guess, where would you say that the center of reactivity is on bromomethane? If anything's going to react, if any portion of that molecule is going to react, where is it going to be most likely? Heard a couple of answers. Bromine's going to be involved, but it's really the carbon that's going to end up being attacked in this case. Why do you think a molecule like this would even be reactive? What structural property of this molecule might make it attractive to other molecules to attack? Well, why would another molecule even approach this molecule? You know, other than the fact that things move around in solution, what might draw hydroxide to that carbon? Halogens tend to be electronegative. It's going to pull electron density away from the carbon and make the carbon slightly positively charged. We have this fully negatively charged hydroxide that just on the basis of charge alone then should be attracted towards that carbon. And in fact, there's two terms that we often use in organic mechanisms. One is electrophile. which literally means electron loving. So if it's something that likes electrons, it's seeking out negative charge. And then the opposite is nucleophile, which that term comes from the fact that nuclei are positively charged. So nucleophile means something that seeks positive charge. So in this reaction, the hydroxide would qualify as the nucleophile. Arrow is just pointing to show nucleophile. It's not a mechanism arrow. In fact, just to make sure that we don't confuse this, I'll rewrite it below. And I'll go ahead and point out then that the alkyl halide, the haloalkane, is the electrophile. And so what does happen in this reaction is hydroxide will attack the carbon center. Remember that the way that these arrows work is that the tail of the arrow shows where electrons come from, and the head of the arrow shows where electrons go to. So this means a pair of electrons come from hydroxide and attack and make a bond with carbon. Except that carbon is tetravalent, meaning it can only have a maximum of 4 connections to it. So something has to give. What makes more sense to give will be bromine, since it's already pulling electron density away from the carbon. And so we'll end up with an alcohol, methanol, as the product. Plus, we'll have this bromide ion that's just floating around in solution. We'll see later on that this is called a substitution reaction because we're taking that bromine and replacing it with something else. So this also, in Chem 50 terminology, I guess would be a single replacement reaction. But in organic sense, we call it a substitution reaction. Now let's look at a series of alkyl halides to see how the reaction might differ in terms of rate from one compound to the next. So we already looked at methyl bromide, bromomethane. Let's compare it with bromoethane, 2-bromopropane or isopropyl bromide. And actually, I named this compound incorrectly earlier. This would be 2-bromo-2-methylpropane, or more shortly, T-butyl bromide. Now, in that last compound, the T-butyl bromide, what kind of carbon do we have at the point where bromine attaches? A tertiary carbon, okay? And what do we have in the next compound over, the isopropyl bromide? The secondary carbon. And then the primary position? Oh gosh. The next compound? Primary. Then what would we name the methyl bromide? Well, we don't have a term for it because there aren't any carbons attached. So numbering wise, if I was following this scheme, I would say it's 0 degree. What you really just call it in real life is a methyl group. So you could say methyl halide, primary halide, secondary halide, or tertiary. It turns out there's a vast difference in reactivity between these different compounds. Which the order activity is, the methyl halides are the most reactive, most quickly reacting of the compounds, followed by the primaries, followed by the secondaries, and a far distant finish for the tertiaries. In fact, tertiaries are so slow that they're pretty much not reactive. Based on the reaction mechanism, can you come up with a reason why this behavior might be true? Yeah. That's exactly it. And what's the term that we call that effect? Same term that we called that when we were talking about why different rotamers have different energies, or why different cyclohexane conformers have different energies. Steric hindrance. So if you look at that T-butylbromide, it's really deceptive the way it's written down on paper, because it looks like such a small stick figure. But recognize that each of those three methyl groups has three hydrogens on it. So there's nine hydrogens plus those three carbons that kind of form a shield around that whole molecule. Notice that the mechanism is one in which the hydroxide is attacking at the same time that the bromide is coming off. So the hydroxide has to be able to get into and get its way towards that reactive center. And if there's too much stuff blocking its route, the reaction just won't occur. And so, yes, this is an effect of steric hindrance. So methyl and primary alkyl halides are much more reactive in this particular mechanism because they have less steric hindrance around the reactive site. So this is our first example of seeing a relationship between structure and reactivity. Again, when we have something like the T-butyl group, where there's so much steric hindrance that the hydroxide can't come in, that's why it doesn't react. The methyl group, there's practically nothing there. So the hydroxide has an easy time attacking, and that's why the rate is so much greater. Now, one other aspect of this, though, which is particularly timely since we've now had our second lecture on stereochemistry. R or S? You're correct. Hydrogen is in the back, and so whatever we see, we report. In other words, we don't have to reverse it. Chlorine is the most important substituent. Why? The highest atomic number. So in terms of the atomic number, we have chlorine, carbon, and two different kinds of hydrogen. Chlorine is the higher atomic number, so it's priority one. Carbon is priority two. Between the two different types of hydrogens, how do we decide between them? In other words, between hydrogen itself and deuterium. Mass number. That's the sub rule. So first, it's atomic number, but then when you get to a tie, then it's mass number. So deuterium, higher mass number than the hydrogen.
which is unwritten in the back. Since this is all oriented the correct way, we could read from, we can read around the circle and figure out it's S. If I wanted to name this compound, remember that, well, maybe I didn't highlight this the other day, ran out of time, that if we only have one stereocenter on the molecule, you don't need a number for the stereocenter. In other words, I could just start out with S without a number, because a chemist that writes the structure down would recognize, oh, there's only one stereocenter. And so you'd know which way to write it. S, then we have a chloro substituent and a deutero. Remember that deutero is our substituent name for deuterium. I believe that's at least the second time now we've seen that deutero prefix. So what do you think the likelihood of deuterium showing up in an RNS problem on your quiz will be? It's very high. This is, in fact, well, wait, what number would be given to the substituent positions? One. Now, this morning, I think some people were misinterpreting this line as being a methyl group, but because the deuterium is there, it's just a deuterium. So this is the end of the carbon chain, so this position is itself position one. So this compound is S1-chloro-1-deutero, and then we have four carbons total, so it's butane. This isn't the real reason I put this up here to cover naming. It's because of how this molecule reacts. As I said a moment ago, the reaction between hydroxide and this alkyl halide, it's a simultaneous reaction in that at the same time the hydroxide's coming in, the carbon-chlorine bond breaks. Well, that means there's a particular geometry that occurs as the reaction proceeds. In fact, to get really technical, the hydroxide puts electrons in the antibond of the carbon-chlorine bond. Well, what does that mean? Well, if you had a carbon-chlorine bond, and now you put electrons in that same antibond, the bond's going to break. That's why the carbon-chlorine bond goes away. But because it's going away, the oxygen's there, it now forms a bond with carbon. But because of the specific arrangement, the geometrical arrangement, again, something is coming in at the same time that something else is going out, that means that the product you end up with will have a reversed configuration. And this is called inversion of configuration. The geometry at a stereocenter is inverted during a reaction. Why do we care about this? Well, last week when I did introduce the topic of stereochemistry, I had said that you can end up in situations where you'll have enantiomers, mirror image molecules, where one form might be beneficial and one form might be harmful. So it matters entirely whether or not that wedge or dash does change or not during a chemical reaction. So this is our first chance to connect mechanism to what kind of stereocenter we're going to end up with. Yes? Not yet, but this topic, nucleophilic substitution, we have a day for in the syllabus. This is just the overview for right now. So we will get back more into detail later. There's one side detail that we're not even going to revisit today. But because there's this aspect of stereochemistry that you could worry about, I want to put another term up here Again, one that we will worry about in the future. And that is regiochemistry. Which, let me see how I worded it before. I'm trying to stay consistent. So, regiochemistry refers to whether reaction takes place at just one reaction site, or whether you might get the possibility of forming different structural isomers. In other words, whether the reaction might occur at different places along the molecule. In this example, you can see that the nucleophile, the thing that wants positive charge, is substituting at exactly the same place every time, where the halogen is, where that delta positive is. So it has very regular, predictable regiochemistry. So regiochemistry refers to whether a reaction occurs at only one site or at multiple sites. So, we have this reaction, something's getting substituted. It involves a nucleophile, so in fact this is called nucleophilic substitution. But more specifically, the version of the reaction I've shown you so far is referred to as bimolecular nucleophilic substitution. Or SN2 for short. S for substitution, N, which is often written as a subscript but capital, that stands for nucleophilic, and then the two, bimolecular. Yes? No. Regiochemistry, that's a separate idea that refers to any reaction as far as whether it happens at one place or multiple. Bimolecular nucleophilic substitution is the name of the reaction that I've been showing you examples of so far today. What does the term bimolecular mean? Has to do with a rate law. What are rate laws? Or what's the general form of a rate law?
R.
Okay, there's some concentrations that get thrown in there, and there's this K thing that we'll find out is the rate constant. What determines which concentrations get put into this expression? What? Well, but order is determined by the number of concentrations in there. What, in terms of a chemical reaction, establishes which compounds go into the rate law? But you can have multiple reagents that, that change concentration, but that don't change the rate of reaction. I got a room full of my old Chem 1B students that I think I'm going to have to send back to Chem 1B, aren't I? Do any of you remember this phrase, rate limiting step? No? Some of you? What about something like this? Does this diagram look at all familiar to any of you? Kinda. Oh my gosh, I really am going to send you back to 1B. This is a reaction coordinate diagram, which monitors the energy of a reaction as it progresses from reactants to products. There are several important features that we often point out on one of these reaction coordinate diagrams. one of which is activation energy. Which is related to this concept, that you can have a match, and no matter how bad a mood you might be in, you can stare at that match all day long, but it's not likely to light all by itself. Or if it does, then you're super special. But barring that, you've got to strike it. You've got to add friction, which adds kinetic energy, which adds the energy necessary to get molecules up over this hump. Kind of like an amusement park ride. Once you get up to the top, then it's pretty much a downhill ride, you hope, afterwards. Well, this tallest, toughest part of the reaction, in between reactants and products, that's called a transition state. Transition state is the highest energy moment as you go transitioning from reactants to products. So notice, though, that you might have multiple individual steps in a reaction. This particular diagram is not representative of the reaction I've been showing you so far. But what it's showing you is an example of something that has multiple transition states, multiple tough moments. But one of these activation energies is a lot larger than the other. To go from the very beginning, the reactants, up to the first transition state is a lot of energy. To go from this intermediate to the next transition state is just a little bit of energy. And in general, the rate of reaction is controlled by the step that has the largest activation energy, and that step is known as the rate-limiting step. So again, in a reaction, you might have multiple steps. They'll each have their own activation energies. The one with the largest activation energy tends to control the rate of reaction. Why? Because the rate constant that we throw in, there's a formulation for it that involves activation energy as one of the prime variables. So just in a purely mathematical analysis, if we increase EA, KA goes down. The rate of reaction goes down. But that's a lame way to argue this, because all I'm doing is using the equation. Physically, what's going on? Well, again, geared towards my former students, here's a diagram that you saw over and over and over again if you were in 1B. Which represents the fact that at any particular temperature, you're going to have a distribution of energies of molecules. For example, at room temperature, water evaporates, even though the boiling point of water is 100 degrees Celsius. That's because some of the molecules are moving fast enough that they can escape. Well, the same thing happens in a chemical reaction. If you establish an activation energy, that means a fraction of molecules are going to have that amount of energy and can react, while others won't have enough energy. If you raise the activation barrier, you lower the number of molecules that have enough energy, which is why the largest activation energy controls the rate of reaction. So what does bimolecular mean? It means there's two molecules involved in the rate-limiting step. How do we know this reaction is classified as bimolecular? Well, let me put the reaction mechanism back up for a moment. Do you see any ones or twos indicating the order that these arrows occur in? In other words, is there any indication with the way that I've drawn the mechanism that there's any kind of timing involved? No, and that's on purpose, because when you write multiple arrows on one diagram, it means they all happen at the same time. What's called a concerted reaction. Not writing that down, because we have a whole day on just mechanisms coming up.
But because both of the molecules are involved at the same time, because both the nucleophile and what I refer to as the substrate, the target organic molecule that's getting transformed during this reaction, because the nucleophile and the substrate are both involved simultaneously in the rate-limiting step, that's why it's called a bimolecular nucleophilic substitution. Now, given how much you all appear to have forgotten about rate-limiting steps and rate laws and molecularity and first order, second order, third order, and all that, that's why we have a day for kinetics coming up. So again, I want to emphasize this is all overview, but it's to show you kinetics are going to matter. But this is only half the story. Because if I take T-butyl bromide and react it in water under certain conditions, which in chemistry, what does a triangle pointing up refer to? Heat. So this alkyl halide, if it's heated in the presence of water, we're going to make an alcohol. As a separate reaction, if I take the same methyl bromide that we saw before, but instead of hydroxide, I react it with water and heat, nothing happens. Which NR is a common abbreviation for no reaction. But a minute ago, we were talking about how hydroxide reacts much better with things like methyl bromide because there's not that much steric hindrance to get in the way of the hydroxide. And that T-butyl bromide would be a terrible molecule to use with hydroxide because hydroxide can't get to the carbon center. But this is not hydroxide, this is water. So can any of you think of a reason that this T-butyl bromide is more reactive? What if, when you use water, the reaction does not occur all at once? Because think of what the story was with hydroxide. Hydroxide was forcing its way into the molecule, attacking that carbon position, and forcing the bromine to come off. Would you say water is more or less nucleophilic than hydroxide? Would you say water is more or less nucleophilic than hydroxide? Which one wants positive charge worse, the negatively charged hydroxide or the neutral water? Negatively charged. If you have negative, it wants positive. If you have neutral, it could care less. So this is not as good a nucleophile that we're using, water. Then what's happening in this reaction? Well, what if the bromine could come off all by itself for some reason? What is the shorthand term that we use to describe an organic molecule where the positive charge is on a carbon? Carbocation. And specifically, this is a tertiary carbocation. What if I told you that tertiary carbocations form much more rapidly than methyl or primary carbocations? Well, that might explain this reaction, because notice it's the methyl bromide that doesn't want to react. Can you think of a reason that the tertiary carbocation might be more favorable and was able to form? There's that magic word that we skipped over the other day, hyperconjugation. To tell you the story of hyperconjugation, though, I'm going to do it backwards from what I did this morning, because it doesn't help a whole lot to tell you what hyperconjugation is if you don't know what conjugation is. So I'm going to show you conjugation, then I'll show you hyperconjugation.
So it's a side story. I've just drawn up two structures that are used to represent what's referred to as the allyl cation. So you've had these common names so far of isopropyl, isobutyl, secbutyl, tert-butyl, neopentyl. But there are other structures that also have common names, one of which is allyl, which is what you see here. A double bond with a single carbon on the other side and something else on that single bonded carbon. So since we've got a cation there, that's why it's called the allyl cation. Common name if we put an OH group on it would be allyl alcohol.
And you'll see a few other names, some of which you'll encounter today, in fact, as you do your reaction. Benzyl, phenyl, crotyl. So allyl's just another common name word. Now, which of the two structures for allyl carbocation is correct, the ones I've drawn? So I see that look. It's the look of, okay, we know that you're asking a trick question because the two structures are identical. So the correct answer is neither. Neither of these represents the structure of the molecule, because in real life, there is no double bond and single bond. They're both about the same length as a 1.5 bond. There is no difference between the three different carbons. They're equally distant from each other, the two on the left and the two on the right. How is that possible? What if we drew a smog diagram? Now, for those of you who had hoped that smog diagrams would go away after the test, you're going to have smog diagrams on every test from now to the end of 12C. Because it's the only way we can describe what I'm about to show you. There is no other way other than just some lame waving your hands in the air explanation. Let's see why this is so important. What is the hybridization of the carbon where the positive charge is located, at least in this drawing? Let me ask that again. What is the hybridization of the position where the positive charge is? I heard the correct answer, but I didn't hear it very confidently. If you do not know how to do hybridization, realize that that is going to be the foundation for these smog diagrams, which means if you don't learn it, you're going to be hosed from now until the end of Chem 12C. That's the reason that it was a topic for the first test. It's the groundwork to make it through the rest of OChem. So if you don't know how to determine hybridization, then you need to come to office hours or talk to me during lab so I can make sure I catch you up, because otherwise you never will catch up. You won't make it. You have to know how to do a smog diagram. You have to know how to determine hybridization. No other choice.
So how do you determine it? Well, there are two unwritten, and only two unwritten, hydrogens on that position.
If you look back at the example molecules we did when we did smog diagrams, remember the methyl cation, it only had three bonds to it. So carbon is positively charged if you only have three bonds and no other electrons attached. Since we only have three bonds, we need three unique ways that those hybrid orbitals are going to point. Three unique hybrids, which that means three atomic orbitals, which is why it's sp2. Now, what about either of the carbons in the double bond? What would their hybridizations be? They're also sp2, yes, because there's only three single bonds on any of those carbons. Remember that the pi bond doesn't count for hybridization.
So if they're all sp2, let's draw a smog diagram for this cation. So there's sp2 hybridization, and then I've got my p orbitals.
Well, here's the question for you. Which pair of p orbitals do I connect? Well, the same problem is how do I draw the structure? If the two p orbitals on the left-hand side are close enough to overlap, so are the p orbitals on the right. There isn't just one overlap that occurs. You do not have a pi bond, you have a pi system. This is resonance. Period. This is what resonance is. It's not that you have two molecules. It's not that you use multiple structures to represent it. Well, yes, we do. And the reason we have to is you can't write that bond using normal line structures. Some people try to. They try to do things like this. But it's a horrible idea because you can't count electrons that way. That's the whole point of using line structures, or not the whole point. One major point of writing structures down is to count where electrons go. Well, since the electrons aren't just in one place, that's why you can't write just one structure. That's resonance. This is also conjugation. Conjugation is where you have a bonding interaction due to the overlap of orbitals on more than two atoms. So in this system, the allele system, we would say that the p orbitals are conjugated with each other. That it's not just two making a pi bond, it's three making something special. Yes?
Once you draw the line to connect the first pi bond, the third
one is that the p. What if I did just this instead of that? Is that what you're saying?
No, the first and the third instead of the second and the third.
They're not close enough. So the question is, why did I connect the line from the first to the third? Because they don't make a triangle. If you got rid of these hydrogens and you pull the molecule around and make it a cyclopropane type of molecule, and then if each one had a p orbital, they would all be conjugated with each other. The first and the third would then overlap. But because they're not close enough, because there's not a bond connecting them, that's why there's no overlap there. Yes? That was the case of a diradical. But in this case, they do overlap. So the p orbitals are not perpendicular in this molecule. They are parallel, which is why all three of them overlap.
There is no double bond.
There is no double bond in this molecule. This is a fake structure. This is where we try to represent this molecule on paper, but we can't. That's why we need resonance structures. So So you can't look at that and say, where's the double bond? There is no double bond. It's just the way that we write it on paper. There's p orbital on all three positions, though, and that's the point. All three of them overlap simultaneously. So you don't have a pi bond where you have just a bonding orbital and an anti-bonding orbital. You have, in this case, three orbitals. Bonding, non-bonding, anti-bonding. And that's a topic we'll get much deeper into when we tackle resonance properly. I know this might be confusing to you, but all of this I'm presenting only so I could do the following, to show you what hyperconjugation is. Because let's go back to what the real story we were working on was. Why is it that this tertiary alkyl halide can form a carbocation at all, while it appears not to happen for bromomethane? Well, let's draw a smog diagram now of this tertiary carbocation. Which, could I borrow purples from somebody? Yes. There are two cases where the p orbitals will be perpendicular to each other. One that you've already seen is for vicinal diradicals. Anytime they have a radical on atoms that are next door to each other, the only way to keep them as radicals is if the p orbitals are perpendicular. The only other case that we'll see is for what are called cumenes, which is when you have a double bond connected to a double bond. So in this case, one set of p orbitals, in fact, let me ask you this question. What is the hybridization of the central carbon in that molecule? SP, not SP2. You can't automatically say, oh, double bond SP2, even though 9% of the time you'd be right. But this is the 1% of the time you'd be wrong. Because there's only two atoms attached to the central carbon, that's why it's only SP hybridization. Well, that means you have one p orbital that's pointed in the plane of the paper, and you have another p orbital that's pointed out at you. Well, the one that's in the plane of the paper makes a double bond with one atom on one side. The other p orbital that's perpendicular makes another pi bond with the atom on the other side. And the two do not overlap. But we're now far enough away from the central topic that I'm going to ask that we just move back to talking about nucleophilic substitution. So we're working on a smog diagram for this carbocation. The central carbon, what is its hybridization? Oh, come on. Oh, wait, no, you didn't have lunch yet. So you're not in food coma. So I mean, I should get a nice, resounding, loud answer. What is the hybridization of the central carbon? There we go. And what about the three methyl groups? What will be their hybridization? SP3, that's right. If you're feeling overwhelmed by this lecture, that's why I'm giving you this lecture. Because every single word of it is going to be on a test at some point or another. Every little detail I've covered is going to be tested this quarter. This is your wake-up call that when I now in the future say, did you read the chapter? Did you do these practice problems? It's because I know this is coming. And I know it's going to be like a wave that washes over you if you're not ready for it. So, here are the SP3 hybridized carbons. We have the SP2 hybridized carbon in the middle. There's the p orbital. And then there's the fact that a sigma bond on a carbon next to the p orbital can occasionally have just the right geometry where there's some small amount of overlap that occurs. Now, this is already a sigma bond, where I've got my pen pointed. Over here, that sp3 hybridized carbon, the bond between carbon and hydrogen, that's a sigma bond. This is an empty p orbital, a non-bonding orbital. So this is not a proper bonding overlap that's being shown here. But it is an overlap. And what will happen is that some electron density from the bond will kind of be funneled, will bleed over, will kind of smear over to where the p orbital is. That means that you've taken the positive charge, which used to reside just on that central carbon, and spread it out a little bit. Spread the burden of tolerating that positive charge out across the molecule a bit. The more that you can dissipate, that was the word I was looking for this morning. The more you could dissipate that positive charge to spread it out, the more stable the molecule tends to be. And in its case, hyperconjugation can occur not with just one neighbor, but three. And remember that all these single bonds are going to be rotating constantly. So it's not that you have three interactions simultaneously all the time. It's just you have three neighbors with which these hyperconjugation interactions are possible. Hyperconjugation is a non-bonding orbital interaction. Which indirectly is going to involve more than two atoms as well. We have the p orbital on the central carbon, and we have the sigma bond of the carbon-hydrogen bond next door. Okay, what's the big deal? Well, let's go back and look at that methyl group. We were trying to explain why would methyl bromide not react. We've already drawn a picture for CH3+. But let's take a look at it. Notice that there's a 90 degree angle between the carbon-hydrogen bonds and the p orbital. So the bonds going from the carbon with the p orbital are in the wrong geometry to be able to overlap with the p orbital itself. So that means that there's no hyperconjugation. In the tertiary, there's three neighbors that have hyperconjugation. Secondary, only two. Primary, only one. This explains the order of reactivity in this kind of substitution reaction. Because if we look at the same types of substrates that we had back when I started this lecture today, same compounds are now going to have reversed relative rates of reaction. Why? Because the difficult part of the reaction, which is the formation of the carbocation, happens more easily with tertiary and secondary substrates, because the carbocation that forms is more stabilized by hyperconjugation. So in this type of reaction, tertiary alkyl halides are much more reactive. Than methyl or primary alkyl halides.
Because the carbocation formed during reaction is more stable. And I'll just go up and make this note that methyl and primary alkyl halides are, for most purposes, non-reactive by this reaction mechanism. Let me write the full mechanism out, because I started this whole discussion of this particular reaction by saying, what if the bromine came off by itself? But I haven't yet shown you what happens after. So in that reaction mechanism, carbon-halogen bond breaks. Why? Because there's enough energy around to get over the activation barrier to break that bond. No other reason. Well, there is a reason, because once you do make the carbocation, it's not as bad as if you didn't have a tertiary alkyl halide. Once you form the carbocation, now water can come in for the attack. But, you know, just to consolidate the discussion a bit, what's the geometry of that carbocation? I heard a couple answers. So it's sp2 hybridized, but they're no lone pairs. So that means it's trigonal planar. Which means, if the molecule is entirely symmetric, then is there going to be any preference for the water, attacking from the top or the bottom? It'd be a 50-50 shot, wouldn't it? Everything else being equal. So let's say the molecule is symmetric, because that's pretty darn symmetric. There is a, there is an effect that goes on solution that we'll study later that will make this not quite be so even. But for the moment, we could say water attacks from two different positions. I'll show you that in another example, because even if I tried to use dashes and wedges on what I'm about to write as the product, it wouldn't have a stereo center anyway. Notice that in this particular case, even though attack from two directions is possible, there's no stereo center, so there's no need to worry about attack, at least on paper. But notice that this is not a final product yet, because once water attacks, water used to be neutral. The oxygen in water was neutral, but because it formed a new bond, it's now positively charged. So one last little step is that a hydrogen comes off and you're left with an alcohol. That's the full mechanism. Before I even wrap up with stereochemistry, let me write down that this is called unimolecular nucleophilic substitution. Or SN1. Why is it called unimolecular? Well, first let me ask you, how many steps are there in this reaction? Three, because I show one arrow followed by what it produced. If I'm then showing a second arrow, that's a second distinct step. There's then a third arrow in yet another step, so three steps total. Out of these three steps, which one would you guess would be the most difficult of them? Why the first one? You're right. The activation energy would be the largest? You're right also. Why? What's happening in steps 1
and 3 that is not happening in step 2. Bond breaking. And bond breaking takes energy. Bond formation releases energy. So out of the 3 steps, step 2 is going to be the most favorable, most likely. Between the first and the last step, that one would be harder at your level of knowledge to guess, except that you might see the oxygen with the positive charge and say, oxygen doesn't like to be positive charged. It's electronegative. So getting rid of that positive charge might be a good thing, and it is. Taking a neutral molecule and trying to break it apart, that's tough. So the first step is the toughest step of the reaction. How many molecules are involved in that rate-limiting step? Only one. That's why it's called unimolecular.
Only one molecule is involved in the rate limiting step, which is the formation of the carbocation. That has a real
life practical consequence, which is that if you're doing this reaction and you throw in a whole bunch of water or a little bit of water, it doesn't really matter because the quantity of water won't change the rate of reaction, because all that matters is whether you form the carbocation or not. Again, that's why it's called unimolecular nucleophilic substitution. Coming back to address that stereochemistry question, if I started out with a secondary alkyl halide and reacted it with water and heat, is this R or S? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. R. Because chlorine is priority 1, it's this, yes. But I can't take that as a test answer. Priority 1 for chlorine, priority 2 for something that's longer than a methyl group. And it's not automatically the longer chain that wins, but since we're just comparing carbons, then the thing with 2 carbons in a chain versus 1 carbon in a chain, the 2 is going to win. So 1, 2, 3, and yes, it's R. But because when you form the carbocation, the very first step is to make a planar intermediate, then when water attacks, unlike what we saw above, we now will form 2 distinct products. Before you even ask it, the answer is yes. On a quiz or an exam, you would have to know that this is going to occur. And to know there's multiple products, because again, stereochemistry is important. To make a commentary on your textbook, it, like other textbooks, takes the following approach to organic chemistry. Let's see a few examples of chemical reactions, and then come back and tackle this difficult thing called stereochemistry, which means then we'll go back and relearn all those same reactions again, but with stereochemistry. And so for those of you who've tried to read the stereochemistry chapter, that's how it's structured. First half is about enantiomers and diastereomers and R and S and chiral and this and that. And the back half of the chapter is all these reactions you haven't learned yet, which is why we're skipping sections around. But anyways, we have these 2 intermediates that form. They're enantiomers of each other. There is one more step where the hydrogen comes off and you make a racemic mixture of alcohols. And that is nucleophilic substitution. One of the 10 or 15 reactions you're learning this quarter. But all the effort that you're going to put in to understand this reaction, these aspects of the reaction, like kinetics, thermodynamics, mechanism, arrows, all the stuff, it's the same stuff we talk about with any reaction. So once you learn how this one works, you're going to apply the same knowledge for any other reaction you do learn. Question, yes. This whole thing is SN1. So the first half of the lecture today, all of it was for SN2. The second half of the lecture, all of it's for SN1. Here is the list of 10 compounds that you're going to be testing in this lab. So you can see we've got some primary alkyl halides, some secondary alkyl halides, a tertiary alkyl halide in there. Compounds with double bonds. In fact, common names you need to know, at least just for the lab. This one with the double bond, a single double bond, its common name is crotyl chloride. And then the compound with a benzene ring, but with one additional carbon between the halogen and the benzene ring, this is called benzyl. So this is the compound benzyl chloride. We also have bromobenzene. Benzene, hopefully you're familiar with, that's why I didn't write that one down. The three compounds involving double bonds, so we'll see how that might affect the reactivity. Then, curiously enough, we have bromocyclopentane and bromocyclohexane, which there is a small difference in the reactivity that we'll talk about much later in the quarter. This lab report, by the way, is not going to be due until later in the quarter, until we have had a chance to come back and talk about the theory behind these reactions. But here's your 10 different compounds. There's two reagents that we're using. One that will cause an SN2 reaction, one that will cause an SN1 reaction. So, back to what I was talking about before we started the recording, you're going to have these 10 different compounds you'll need to make up test tubes for. Yes, each individual compound goes in a different test tube, because you're seeing how each of these 10 compounds will react in SN2 conditions versus SN1 conditions. And yes, you have to clean out and make a new sample once you've done the SN2, because you can't piggyback and do SN2 and then follow it up with SN1, at least not for what we're trying to accomplish. What are these two different reagents that you're using? Well, for SN2, it is a mixture of sodium iodide in acetone. So acetone is a fairly polar organic compound. Polar enough that some small quantity of sodium iodide is soluble in acetone. Turns out, though, that sodium chloride, sodium bromide are not so soluble. And so if you have a reaction where iodide can substitute, let me show you an example reaction mechanism. And I'll go ahead and use one of the compounds that you are going to use in your experiment, because we've already discussed today how primary alkyl halides should undergo SN2. So iodide would kick off the bromide. You form an alkyl iodide as a product. But because bromide is less soluble in acetone than iodide with sodium present, the sodium bromide should form a precipitate. That's what the down arrow is trying to describe. So you make up these different reaction mixtures. If you see a precipitate, you'll call that a successful reaction. Again, maybe just a few drops of each of the target compounds, and then maybe about a milliliter of whichever reagent solution that you're using. So if you see a precipitate, mark that down. If it doesn't form a precipitate, but it gets cloudy, mark that down as well. When you've let the reaction sit around for maybe 5 minutes, if nothing's happened, then heat them up. In fact, you might want to just heat all of them up, even the ones that do react, to see if you get further reaction of some sort. Why? Because sometimes you do need a little heat to get these reactions to progress. So you're going to have the 10 compounds. In each of the 10 compounds, each in a separate test tube, you'll add the SN2 reagent and see if a reaction occurs. Clean everything up, start over again, where you have the same 10 compounds, but the second time around, you do it with a different set of reagents. Silver nitrate
in ethanol. Now,
do not just blindly pick up any bottle that has the word ethanol, as happened this morning, because we have ethanol chloroform mixture left over from the TOC lab. It's still in there. So if you grab that, nothing's going to happen. Make sure you always read your bottles. Don't just grab the first thing you see. Make sure that it's for the silver nitrate ethanol mixture. What's going on in this reaction? Well, why does this encourage SN1 conditions? Because in SN1, the halogen comes off first. And if you have a free halogen with silver present, you might remember your solubility rules, that halogens are normally soluble, at least in aqueous solutions, unless there's silver, mercury, or lead present. We have silver present. And so if a halogen comes off, it's going to precipitate.
And so here's an example mechanism for what happens in the SN1 case. The halogen comes off. You form a carbocation. You'll have the halogen that will end up precipitating. And then there's ethanol left over. Ethanol may be the solvent, but it's also the reactant. In fact, for SN1 reactions, the reactant is often made the solvent, so you can flood the reaction with it. After that bond forms, it's much like the situation we saw with water. We'll initially have a positively charged species. But positively charged oxygen is not favorable. So the hydrogen that had been on the oxygen will come off and will form this product. Which, what functional group is this product? An ether. So you're going to be making a sequence of ethers.
Again, same thing here. Mix these up at room temperature, see if you get a reaction. If you don't get a reaction, heat them up. All waste from today's experiment goes into the organic waste bucket. None of it goes into the aqueous waste. Silver nitrate. It's a dilute solution, but how many of you know what one of the unwanted properties of silver nitrate is? Yes, it stains clothes and skin. So if you took a concentrated solution of silver nitrate and drew on yourself, which I'm not recommending this, I'm just saying what happens, you're going to end up with a tattoo that will last 2-3 weeks until your skin grows out, because you'll oxidize your skin. So it's not a good way to get a temporary design, but it will happen. Your clothes, you'll just permanently stain because they can't grow out. But you're oxidizing your clothes and therefore ruining them. So you want to be, if you wore nice clothes today, be careful with the silver nitrate. All right, so again, for repeating some of the things that happened off microphone, please come up with some logical assembly line style way of getting all these different reagents. Remember that halogens technically can have the potential to be carcinogens, so you want to minimize your exposure. So do not leave the bottles just sitting open ever. If you're the last person to use a bottle, now everybody that's starting to move, pay attention to me, because I was starting to get aggravated with the first section, and aggravated means looking to take points off. Because right after I said don't leave a bottle open, someone just left a bottle open, because they thought, oh, someone else will use it. But if everybody says that, then the bottle just sits there, and we all get exposed, and nobody closes it. So if you're the last person to use a bottle, close it. The next person can always pick it up and open it again. Not such a big deal. We're not going to have time to finish the experiment today. It must have been the last time I taught this course, I did this preview lecture in lecture. So most likely you'll just have time to do one set of reactions. You do need to return what test tubes you can, even though we might have a whole bunch, just to reduce the strain on the stockroom. Cleaning. I know I must have said something about cleaning, but I want to repeat it because I saw it happen. If you want to clean a test tube out, how much liquid do you think you should put in here to clean it out with? Again, if you want to clean a test tube out,
What do you think the best amount of liquid to put in here would be to efficiently clean the test tube? I'll start at the top. You tell me when to stop, and that'll be the liquid level that you're telling me that's a good level. There. So all of you that said stop way before, if you fill your test tube up in here and shake it, the liquid's hardly going to get shook around. You need to physically agitate that liquid if you're going to have any kind of cleaning action, because sometimes just contact between solute and solvent does nothing. So if you already got all the way filled up, there's no headspace, we would say, to be able to shake it even. You need just a milliliter of acetone, for example. Shake that around, pour it out, that does a much better job. I know this seems silly that I'm having to tell you how to clean glassware, but that's because, as a whole, not you, not this class, not this quarter, but OCHEM students love to bathe in acetone because they think it's just as expensive as water. But it's not. The shipping costs are more than the acetone itself. Realize it's a liquid, it's flammable, it can only be shipped in certain ways, so it's pricey. So the moral of the story is that there's some squirt bottles in the back of the classroom there. The stock room will refill them once per class, which means you get two bottles total to use, and if you run out, then you run out. They will not get you more. I will not get you more. Because you must, I insist, that you be more conservative about the way that you clean your glassware. Acetone is, unfortunately, a little better choice of reagent to use to clean this reaction out, because water can have an effect on nucleophilic substitutions, and you're already using acetone as the solvent for the first experiment, for the SN2 experiment. So acetone is in the red squirt bottles, and if they're empty now, you can take them at the beginning of class, and they'll fill them, but they won't fill them again this period. So keep that in mind as we get to the rush get out of here at 2:10. Any questions about what you need to be doing? Then let's go ahead and get started.